This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Thank you all for coming for this third panel in the three-part series that Lori Cole has put together. And it's an opportunity to thank Lori for her amazing work on this. Thank you, Lori, for three great panels. And Lori's going to present our panelists tonight, but thank you all for joining us, and I'll hand over to Lori.
So I, in turn, would like to thank Sina Najafi for all of his support and for all of Cabinet Magazine's support in putting these events together. And I'd like to thank our panelists for so generously donating their time and their expertise for joining us tonight. And thank you all for coming. So before we begin, I just wanted to give you a brief overview of the series as a whole and tell you a little bit about what to expect this evening. So the idea behind the series was to bring together academics who study magazines, and magazines are increasingly an object of scholarly inquiry, to bring them into conversation with editors, artists, critics, readers, to jointly assess the magazine as a medium. So the way we decided to do that was to structure the series around three sites of interaction between editors and sometimes their readers or contributors, namely the interview, the questionnaire, and the letter to the editor. So we previously held two events, one on the interview, one on the questionnaire, and the subject of tonight's panel is the letter to the editor, which is arguably the most democratic and open of the three forms, since it's one of the only opportunities for readers to publish their work in magazines. And I think that letters to the editor just vary wildly. They can be responses from critics, from artists who, or writers feeling defensive about how people have critiqued them. I always think about Robert Storr's 8,000-word rebuttal to coverage of the Venice Biennale in 2008 in Art Forum in that vein. But at their loftiest, they can be a form of civic participation. So recently, the New York Times created a letter to the editor writing contest for teenagers to try to train them in this form of civic participation. So there's a real range, gossipy, defensive, noble. And so some of the questions that I want us to address tonight are: what makes for a good letter to the editor? Who reads letters to the editors? How do editors select the letters? And also, how do these letters in turn affect a publication's platform or identity? So to address some of these questions, we have with us tonight Carrie Snyder, who's going to moderate the panel, and she is an associate professor of English at Ohio University, and she's going to provide some historical context for the letter to the editor. Her focus of her research is British modernism, so she's going to historicize this for us, and then we will hear from each of our panelists. First from Dan Fox, who is a co-editor of Freeze magazine, and he'll provide a kind of editorial perspective on soliciting and printing letters to the editor. And then we'll hear from Ruth Graham, a journalist who is an avid reader of letters to the editor and has interviewed other letter to the editor writers. So please join me in welcoming our panelists, and thank you again for coming.
Can you hear me? Is it working? Yes, we're good. Okay. Thank you, Lori, for inviting me to participate in this panel, and I'm really looking forward, thank you, panelists, I'm really looking forward to hearing what they both have to say about the genre. So as Lori said, I'm going to be contextualizing, giving some examples, historical examples of the form, a very brief overview of the genre. Okay, can you hear me in the back?
Okay.
How's this? Lean into the mic. Okay. I'm new to mics. I don't really deal with mics very much. Okay. So letters to the editor have been a regular feature of magazines since their inception in the 18th century. Anticipating the more interactive media forums of today, letters sections concretize the public sphere ideal of democratic participation, allowing readers to take part in a wider conversation, one usually but not always initiated by the magazine. In this way, letters provide an interface between private life and public identity, an opportunity to forge community and enact public debate. Letters allow readers to respond to and shape the magazine while reciprocally enabling the magazine to help define and consolidate its audience. So why do readers write letters to the editor? This is obviously a big question that I can't answer, but I hope our panel will speak to. But some of the earliest reader letters belong to a robust subgenre of the category, which is the advice column, where readers seek information on a wide range of topics, legal, medical, interpersonal, professional. Apart from seeking advice, readers have historically written into magazines for at least three broad reasons. One, to criticize, correct, or expand on a magazine's coverage. Two, to praise the magazine or its features. And three, more generally, to share their opinions or experiences in a public forum. From an editorial standpoint, letters columns serve the magazine's commercial interests in that they give readers a sense of ownership of the magazine. You could say they create kind of brand loyalty, but as I've already said, they do more than that. They create discursive communities, I think. So since published letters represent only a glimpse into reader response selected from the small subset of readers who actually write in, I want to talk a little bit about the selection criteria or the typical way that letters are selected before moving on to some historical examples. So noting that periodicals may receive as many as 10 to 50 times the number of letters that they can print, Rasmus Kleiss Nielsen, the director of research for the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, identifies five key selection criteria. So he says, one, letters are selected for their news value. They have to be topical, timely. Two, for their brevity and clarity, their quality of the writing, you know, as you would expect. Three, the extent to which they're individualized. So letters are supposed to be somebody speaking on their own behalf, not trying to represent a whole group. Four, disagreement is favored. So letters that emphasize the surprising, the extraordinary, and sometimes controversial are preferred, Nielsen notes. And then five, fairness. So there's a sense that one or two letters from each side, if you can limit issues to sides, are presented. And an author that's criticized typically gets a right to reply. With regard to the emphasis on disagreement rather than consensus, Nielsen notes that criticism of the organization and its coverage is given priority, and letters give readers a chance to talk back either to an article or to a particular a previous letter. This function of the letters column is evident in contemporary magazines like The New Yorker or Atlantic Monthly or any number of magazines, although they print, I would say, a multitude of responses, not just two sides. This is often a sense of extending an issue or complicating an issue. However, the emphasis on controversy and disagreement does not account for letters that are fundamentally positive, such as those discussed by Ruth Graham in her article, Meet the People Who Still Write Letters to the Editor. So I'll be interested in hearing her view on the laudatory and the prevalence of those kinds of letters and what function they are serving as well. Finally, Nielsen draws attention to the long-standing tradition of periodicals fabricating letters to the editor, which is one of the more interesting areas, I think. When they feel that the inflow is not contentious enough, Nielsen writes, all editors rely on cohorts of paid or unpaid writers they know that can always play devil's advocate. The interviewed editors in his study insist that extracting, or we could say concocting, disagreement is sometimes necessary precisely because the actual homogeneity of readers' views may not provide enough contention in itself. The disagreement has to be kept alive, also because it's presumed to keep the letters going, and the number of reactions elicited from readers and external parties is considered a measure of success, so a way of stoking controversy. This emphasis on accentuating and even orchestrating controversy and then fabricating letters to do this is very much an evidence in a magazine I study called The New Age, which I'm going to talk about in a bit. So such letters are slipped in without readers' knowledge in order to create a sense of debate. In other cases, however, fictitious letters advertise their own fictionality for humorous or satirical purposes. Sometimes this can be signaled by an obvious pseudonym. So in the New Age, the pseudonym G-Wiz or es verdad, it's the truth, you know, kind of tips you off that this is a fictitious person writing in. I was under the impression that Dan Fox's magazine that he edits had bogus letters in there from the mailbox column. It turns out I was wrong about that. They aren't bogus letters, so I'll be interested to hear more about that. Not for comic purposes, actual readers. Anyway, So now I'm going to give some historical examples. And I have some slides. Let's see. There we go. Okay. And I'm not expecting you to be able to read the text on them. It's really mostly just to give you a sense of the look of the magazines that I'm mentioning here. Okay, so the Gentleman's Magazine, founded by Edward Cave in London in 1731, is often considered to be the first magazine in the modern sense. A monthly digest of news and commentary where Samuel Johnson got his start, it included a correspondence section in which readers addressed their letters to Mr. Urban, which was the pen name of the editor and his successors. The correspondence section comprised close to 20% of the magazine's content. Considerably more space than contemporary correspondence columns, at least that I'm familiar with, where you might have 1 to 4 pages in a 100-page magazine devoted to letters. But like letter writers today, those who corresponded with Mr. Urban wrote in with corrections, augmentation, and praise of previous articles. They also responded to other letters, posed questions to other readers, forging links in a social network produced by the magazine. To a degree that would be unusual today, readers also raised their own topics, sharing knowledge not related to the magazine's coverage. Those letters were, in effect, short articles, the readers becoming de facto contributors, and on a really wide range of topics. Some were scientific, some were current events. There were also literary ones. For instance, one individual wrote in, and noted his pleasure in hearing that another volume of Edmund Malone's companions to Shakespeare was going to be published. And then he offers his own kind of ad hoc literary criticism, which is really just scattered notes on Much Ado About Nothing and Measure for Measure. And then he concludes with the comment, "If any of my remarks should appear to be worthy of the author's notice, they are very much at his service." So what's interesting about this is that this topic, Edmund Malone, who is, turns out, a celebrated early critic of Shakespeare, that he had not been discussed in the magazine. So this reader is introducing this new topic, and he's also assuming that Edmund Malone is reading this magazine, and he's using it as a forum to share with him as well as other interested readers. So the rise of so-called new journalism in the 1880s and 1890s, with its chatty style, brief article format, and appeal to human interest, led to a greater emphasis on reader engagement. The editor was represented, according to one magazine scholar, as the reader's intimate rather than a distant authority figure. Editor George Newen struck this chord. There we go. By referring to his readers as friends in the mass circulation magazine Titbits that he founded in 1881. And this was one of the most popular magazines in the fin de siècle. And it was titbits of information from other publications, so a kind of digest. But it also had one of its most important sections, popular sections, was the correspondence. And according to media scholar Bridget Foley, it conveyed a sense of editorial presence and reader involvement, thus serving as the linchpin of the interactive posture adopted by the magazine. Similarly, Annie S. Swan's Over the Teacups column in the Sixpenny Monthly Women at Home, which started in 1893, so also fin de siècle, included long, apparently verbatim quotations from readers' letters and detailed synopses, followed by Mrs. Swan's responses, creating, quote, a sense of intimate dialogue between readers and the magazine. So these fin de siècle examples show that the readers are being incorporated into magazines in an important way, but they also show a great deal of editorial intervention. So the letters aren't just standing on their own. They're very much mediated by the editor. And that question of editorial intervention and mediation is one that I'm interested in and I'm hoping the panelists can address. So The American Magazine, founded in 1876 and featuring the work of muckraking journalists such as Ida Tarbell from 1906 on, provides a contrasting example of a mass circulation monthly which printed readers' letters, apparently verbatim, in the back pages of the magazine. Another interesting variation on the letters column from this period is the Atlantic Monthly's Contributors Club, started in 1877 and endured at least a half a century, it was popular, which featured, like some of the Gentleman's Monthly letters, readers' contributions that were effectively brief articles rather than responses to material from the magazine. I think it seems to me this is a use of letters columns that's withered away, that you don't have entire articles appearing. So in her history of the Atlantic Monthly, Ellery Sedgwick notes that this column served two purposes. It provided, first, less formal, briefer, and often briskly controversial material, and second, an opportunity for little-known writers to establish contact with the Atlantic and perhaps begin a career in print. Thus, the lines between letter and article and letter writer and contributor get blurred in some of these publications. So my last three examples are all taken from the early 1900s, my period of specialization. And two of them are little magazines, so that's a magazine with a circulation of less than 3,000, typically. And the third, the New Age, is not much larger, with circulation ranging from 3,000 to 22,000 at its peak. Perhaps partly because of their small staff size and also because of their progressive politics, all three magazines devoted a great deal of space to letters, averaging 20% of the total content. So the column assumed a degree of prominence that it no longer had in larger publications. And I say no longer because I started by saying the Gentleman's Magazine had 20% of the magazine was readers. But we're not seeing that in the large magazines of the early 20th century. The Little Review, published from 1914 to 1929 and edited by Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap, was an important forum for avant-garde art and literature, perhaps known to some of you for serializing James Joyce's Ulysses until the obscenity trials put a halt to that publication. Not to the magazine, but to them publishing Ulysses. In the magazine's first issue, Anderson invited readers' participation in an editorial that described criticism as the sun and the moon of art, which makes it ebb and flow. The reader was apparently a joint participant in the critical endeavor, for the letters column was entitled Reader Critic. Anderson stressed that the editors were intensely interested in the opinion of Mrs. Jones, which is her figure for kind of the common reader. And in her memoir, Anderson explained that her magazine sought to capture the edgy liveliness of debate, the resistance that made talking worthwhile, an apt description of the relationship that she and Heap cultivated with their readers, who were not as much intimate friends as valued interlocutors in a spirited debate about art, literature, and the magazine itself. The famed 1916 issue, which included 13 blank pages in protest of the dearth of suitable original material to publish. They said, we can't find any good writing or art, so we're going to give you these blank pages. Illustrates not only the importance placed on readers within the magazine, but also the degree to which the editors intervened to shape reader contribution. So along with the blank pages, there were about 9 pages of articles, 2 pages of illustration, and then 4 pages of letters responding to the threat of leaving the pages blank, which Anderson had made in the previous issue. So again, a total of 25% of the actual material was readers' letters, kind of a striking percentage. The letters ranged from laudatory, bravo, to incredulous, I mean, that's what someone said, to incredulous, don't you think you're asking too much, one reader asks, to insulting, the Little Review sickens me. Who are you to expect a staff of ready geniuses to fill your pages? So while willingly publishing critical responses, the editors carefully framed these contributions. For instance, cutting off the most critical response to the blank pages issue and appending the retort, you say the Little Review sickens you? With the above temperature and tongue, I should diagnose the case of auto intoxication. So, retort. In the next issue, a frequent letter contributor, Philadelphia poet Alice Groff, continues the assault, lambasting the editor as a mad little, singular, she says, as a mad little self-made god, setting yourself up on a pedestal as the only judge of art. The editors undermined Groff by appending the heading, "Officer, she's in again," to this selection and printing two laudatory letters following Groff's. As Jane Merrick writes, editorial prerogative obviously delighted Heap and Anderson, whose use of such headings, postscripts, and excerpts create a subtle means of asserting control over their authors and correspondents, especially those who disagreed with them. So I'm interested here in them inviting readers in to this great extent, a quarter of the magazine in this case, and then shutting them down in certain ways and molding their responses and being, frankly, sarcastic with them. So another little magazine of the period that I want to mention briefly is the Self-Conscious. Is the Free Woman. Had the subtitle A Feminist Review when it started. It changed names a few different times. It was founded by Dora Marsden in 1911. The importance of correspondence to the Free Woman cannot be overstated. Marsden called it the most fruitful part of the paper and devoted, now this was unusual, but two-thirds of the September 12, 1912 issue to it, remarking, "We draw special attention to the correspondence column this week. They largely amount to an unbroken challenge of the Free Woman's policy. This is as it should be. It remains for us to reply to that challenge." So really inviting readers to criticize her magazine and then adapting the magazine to in response. Along with critiquing the articles and editorials, letter writers initiated their own topics, which then migrated to the paper proper. And readers engaged one another in dialogue to an unusual degree, so much so that the conversation spilled over the pages of the magazine and a Free Woman's discussion circle was founded and people would go and face-to-face talk about issues that were begun in the pages of the magazine. And the last letters column that I'll discuss is that of the London Socialist Weekly. Oh, I did it again. Go to the New Age. Which I mentioned before, edited by, A.R. Oraj from 1908 to 1922, a weekly review of politics, art, and literature with a tradition of fomenting aesthetic and political controversy. From 1908 to 1916, Beatrice Hastings was the unacknowledged assistant editor and a core contributor, employing over a dozen pseudonyms, as well as publishing signed and unsigned pieces in a wide range of genres. More than half of the pseudonyms were deployed in the correspondence section, which in her memoir, Hastings recalls watching, quote, as the pulse of the paper darting in under some name to stimulate it by picking up a dropped point. Given that one of our panelists has adopted a fake pseudonym himself to intervene in the art magazine Freeze, which he co-edits, I thought this would be an interesting historical precedent to mention. So why do writers don pseudonyms in the letter section or elsewhere? I'm hoping you can tell us. But real readers who contribute to letter sections often have good reason for wanting to preserve their anonymity. For instance, if they're sharing confidential details or expressing a controversial opinion. In 19th century periodicals, anonymity and pseudonymity were actually the norm, rather than the exception, as they were in print culture more generally in the 19th century. We could think of the Brontes, George Eliot, Lewis Carroll, and so on. More recent examples include the Booker Prize-winning author John Banville, writing detective fiction as Benjamin Black, and J.K. Rowling, writing crime fiction as Robert Galbraith. As these scattered examples show, writers adopt pseudonyms for a variety of reasons, such as to be taken more seriously, to express controversial views, or to experiment in another genre. While pseudonym use was common in the New Age, partly serving the pragmatic function of swelling the contributor list, Hastings' proliferation of distinct voices, again over a dozen pseudonyms, was unusual. On occasion, Hastings enlisted these alter egos to puff her own work, And in that, she's not unique. That's been known to happen before. She also pit them against one another in articles and in the letters section to further stoke controversy. So Hastings used pseudonyms as both shields and arsenal within the journal's combative culture of ideas. Again, a journal that particularly kind of thrived on controversy and promoting controversy. So as with my other examples, the letters column was a hefty proportion of the magazine, as many as 5 out of 20 pages of double columned. You can see the layout of it, you know, kind of small font. Pages would be devoted to letters. Staff writers jumped in and out of the letters section, which is an interesting phenomenon when a regular contributor then migrates to the letters column, using letters as a more informal, flippant way to keep the conversation going. Threads might continue for as long as 10 months, with correspondents carrying on a conversation as much with each other as with the main contributors. Hastings also used the letters column for parodies, as when she teamed up with Catherine Mansfield, who was not yet a famous writer, to parody half a dozen popular writers. There, in that tiny print up there that you can't read, including H.G. Wells and Arnold Bennett. These parodies, signed with Mansfield's and Hastings' initials, were prefaced with the remark, "Finding ourselves on Sunday in Ditchling-on-Sea without any literature, we were driven to rely upon memories of our favorite authors. We forward the summaries for the benefit of your readers who may sometime find themselves in similar situation." And then they go on to do these scathing parodies, which are quite funny. The column was dominated, the letters column in the New Age was dominated by real letters or bogus letters that were indistinguishable from real letters. So it wasn't always used for this purpose. In fact, rarely was it used for this kind of comic purpose. And so the question is, why use a letters column in this way? The magazine also had a pastiche column, which was only an occasional column, but it was devoted to parodies and satirical writing. So it's an interesting choice to stick it here, and I'm kind of curious about that thinking. And hope we can talk more about that in the discussion section. But the letters column seems to serve as a low-stakes arena in which to try out an idea or a creative effort. Hastings' first major persona in her journalistic writing was the provocative, pro-militant suffragette Beatrice Tina, which she first deployed to counter the anti-feminism of the socialist Belfort Bax, who argued that women were a privileged class who sought suffrage as a weapon wherewith to carry on a sex war. Tina countered that women's dubious legal privileges constituted an insulting and contemptuous repayment for the odious degradation of maternity and the torture of childbirth. Tina's incendiary remarks incited a storm of reader response in the letters column. Fabian writer Edith Nesbitt called Tina's views of motherhood unholy and unnatural, and another reader charged that the exaggerated feminism of Beatrice Tina is far more dangerous for the suffragist cause than the anti-feminism of Belfort Bax. So Hastings was clearly successful in using pseudonyms to provoke letters and provoke readers while shielding herself from discursive fire. When the conversation began to lag, or when Hastings tired of this persona, she invented another persona, a constitutional suffragist called D. Treformis, who was used to chastise Tina for her militant views. So again, she pits the pseudonyms against each other, and this goes on in many permutations. Like other persona deployed in the letters and feature section alike, this one furnished the author with creative and intellectual license. So she wrote in her memoir, she could not have written so boldly or freely if exposed to the publicity that she should have had by signing everything. So pseudonyms thus allowed Hastings to experiment in voice and perspective, to play devil's advocate, and to change argumentative tact. So to close, the letter space has served as a space not only for readers to contribute and intervene in a wide range of views, my examples show just how various that is, but also for editors and contributors to intervene in their own publications in creative ways. So thank you.
So can everyone hear me all right? Is that that working? Okay. My name is Dan. I'm the co-editor of Freeze. And Freeze has been going for almost 25 years now. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is a very, very obscure period or obscure episode in its history from the early 2000s when I was working for the magazine back in London. So in 2004, Freeze had one of its periodic redesigns. And along with changing the font families we were using and various sort of navigational design elements, we decided to introduce a letters page. Oh, is it not working? Oh, dear. Oh, there we go. Is that better?
Yeah,
all right. So as far as I can remember, there were a couple of reasons for introducing the letters page. I mean, life as an editor can sometimes feel like a life spent watching tumbleweed sort of drift across the tundra. You put these magazines out there and just have no idea how people are responding to them. It's like having a radio permanently tuned to sort of static or something. And reader feedback is pretty rare, and the comments threads on the Freeze website at that time only seemed to be filled with trolls whose sole purpose was to campaign for the reinstatement of figurative painting or something or other. This was 2 years before Twitter even began. And we wanted to know what our readers thought, so we figured we'd have a go at the good old-fashioned letters page as a way of soliciting some sort of response. Another reason was the fabled art forum letters pages of the 1970s, where artists and critics duked it out in public over the most pressing aesthetic issues of the day. So wouldn't it be great, we thought, to have that in Freeze? Surely there must be legions of readers dying to vent spleen over relational aesthetics or the reinvestment of minimalist art history with subaltern narratives or sculptures that leaned against the wall or screen prints of Ian Curtis or whatever it was at that point the talk of the day. So to kick things off, we solicited correspondence from friends and professional acquaintances. And the first letters page we ran included missives from curators Anthony Hudek, Chus Martinez, and Shaheen Mirali. They wrote very, very nice, serious letters. So great, we thought, things will start to warm up. But they didn't. Nobody wrote to us. The second round of letters was in an edition of the magazine themed around political art. And on the cover of that issue, we had the famous photograph of Richard Nixon and Elvis meeting in the White House. So we thought we'd fill the letters page with the brief correspondence that Elvis and Nixon shared, alongside a short letter from photographer Steve Giovinco, who'd written to us for some reason, and someone called Pepe Rockefeller, whom I believe has contributed to Freeze magazine under the pseudonym George Pendle, and also Cabinet. For the third round of letters, our mailbag was still empty, so we started making up correspondence. We thought this might provoke people to write. We made up names or borrowed names of relatives. And letters were penned on a very, very boring name, such as Oliver Cohen from Berlin or Michael Arnold Travis from London. That name was borrowed from Lindsay Anderson's films If and Oh Lucky Man. And Willie Andrews from Worcester. The letters were just as straight in tone, referring to particular pieces in the magazine, trying to get the conversation going. Come the fourth issue of letters, still nothing. We'd even tried offering a free annual subscription to the magazine to anyone who wrote in, but nobody was taking the bait. A bit embarrassing. The sluice gates had not opened, and Freeze Towers was an epistolary desert. We made up more correspondence, more boring names. Henry Marsden from London, Sven Beckstetter from Berlin again. They appeared alongside the occasional genuine letter. There's one in one issue from sociologist Roland Kapfer, who was writing from Lusaka, and one from someone called Kevin Moses in New York, complaining about a grudging review of an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery in London. The fifth time we tried a letters page, it was still no better. No amount of rain dancing we could do seemed to encourage people to write in. The letters we were writing ourselves were either too polite or they were too plain. And then with the sixth issue since the redesign, so roughly 8 or 9 months into the redesign, 6 issues of not getting any letters, our nerves cracked. And perhaps it was the end of a trying or exhausting week, and maybe I was hungover or drunk from the night before, I don't know. I can't remember the reasons, but I wrote the following letter. I'm a freelance curator based in Berlin, Lagos, Moscow, Sao Paulo, Belgrade, Beijing, and Tunbridge Wells. As assistant co-curator of the 1993 exhibition Interrogating the Marginalized, co-director of the forthcoming Ulaanbaatar Biennial, and editor of the anthology Kyrgyzstan Now, Post-Objective Dialogues from the Pan-Asiatic Baltic Fictive Contemporary, I found Jörg Heiser's article Good Circulation, published in issue 90, pertinent to my own position, yet problematic. I see myself as a meta-globalist, curating meta-narrative adjacencies of countries rather than exhibitions, arranging the world according to my own significant ideas. Although Heiser's article was informative about the minor issue of what artists make, I was somewhat surprised that he seemed unaware of my seminal 1997 text, Post-Performative Pulmonary Curativity, in which I outlined my own circulatory role as a post-global proto-galactic curator. Heiser's absence from last year's conference, Where Am I? 21st Century Curating and the Rise of the Low-Budget Airline, speaks volumes. Sincerely, Jean-Philippe Obu Stevenson, Schiphol Airport, Amsterdam. Despite thinking that I'd written possibly the most patently absurd letter that I could, parodying a certain type of egomaniacal super-curator that could be spotted flying around the art world in the early 2000s, some people, professional people with actual grown-up institutional jobs in the art world, wondered if he was real. So for the seventh issue of the Freeze Letters page, alongside a few more straight letters, although we knew they were written in vain, I decided to bring in another character. As a curator, the hardest part of putting any show together is keeping up with the changing fashions in exhibition titles. Where would I be without the advertising section of Freeze? Early issues of the magazine in the 1990s caught the tail end of theory-inspired grammatical word games such as in/site/cited/cited, and a bunch of typographical marks, was the title of one of my earliest curatorial escapades. By the mid-1990s, I noticed a shift away from this form of nomenclature, and so, moving with the times, curated Boozy Nights, London is Really Amazing, and I Have a Great Record Collection. Towards the end of that decade, I investigated more poetic territory with The Trees Have My Name, Yet their Leaves Forget Me Yearly, Nobody Loves Me, Everybody Hates Me, and The Lonely Sky Shall Not Forsake Me. Recently, I've sensed a more radical spirit in the air, and I'm accordingly working on a show concerning relational trends in art practice entitled Why Can't We All Just Get Along? Sincerely, Thomas More, Swindon. The eighth round of letters arrived, and aside from a genuinely grumpy letter from someone called Christopher Jurgensen in Shanghai, and one sweet letter written by my colleague Jennifer Higgy's dad in Canberra, Australia, Obu Stevenson returned. Returning by private jet from my summer break on the remote shark-patrolled South Pacific archipelago home of collectors Rocky and Ludmilla Stallion Tamer, following my visit to La Biennale, where I was a privileged guest of the collector Rasputin Jones on his luxury Mediterranean island hopper L'Evasion Fiscale, I was outraged to read a letter printed in the pages of your summer issue, issue 92, penned by the notorious curatorial recidivist Thomas More. Eyes bulging with increased apoplexy as my finger moved from word to word, it was all I could do to maintain calm as I conducted a simultaneous webcast seminar with my students from the Department of Studio Career Advancement at the Jack Vetriano Academy of Fine Arts in Laos. Notwithstanding Moore's blatant plundering of my far-sighted 1989 essay, London Will Become Really Amazing, for his 1995 study of British neoconceptualist cocaine abuse, London is really amazing. Leaving aside the villainy of his trenchantly puerile approach to exhibition signage, pardoning him from stealing my special edition Clement Greenberg Laocoon commemorative holdall from the luggage reclaim belt at Vladivostok Airport, and graciously overlooking his outdated crypto-Marxist attitudes towards the synergistic marketing of exhibition merchandise, I am filled with rage that Freeze would print anything by the same man who, in 2003, had the temerity to state in his review of my survey exhibition examining the influence of 1920s Krakatoan modernism on the real in contemporary reality, that Obu Stevenson couldn't curate his way out of a children's finger painting class. That I had staged a show of radical infant finger painting at the Gran Canaria Hall of Culture only months earlier was pointedly overlooked. Let it be known that should he dare show his face at November's International Symposium on Slow Motion and Contemporary Video, Is the Black Box Up to Speed? In the Azores, I shall, to quote Russell Crowe, unleash hell. Yours, Jean-Philippe Obel Stevenson, Schiphol Airport, Netherlands. It had now been a year since the redesign. For the ninth and tenth issues of the letters, we were tiring of trying to start a real conversation. We still write the occasional half-hearted letter about some review or feature, but the fun of creating an entirely fictional art world where we could poke fun at all the things we found ridiculous was proving too great a distraction and temptation. Once, for a letter about a show called Razor's Edge, Hair, Hegemonics, and Facial Hirsutism in Post-Conceptual Art, an exhibition tracing the evolving dialectic between facial palation and various tendencies in art since 1968. We mentioned the names of real artists, Lawrence Wiener, Liam Gillick, and Hans Hacker, and a few others. But something about that felt wrong. It felt too easy. It was much more fun to build an entire world. As the letters continued, new characters started to appear. Art patrons, the stallion tamers, and the oligarch collector Rasputin Jones, for instance. There was also Brock Jones, a parody of a type of exploding, dimwit, bad boy New York artist who in the mid-noughts that we've been hearing so much about in London. There was Chip Schwabmunkel, proprietor of downtown New York magazines Oh Andy and Guest List. There were artists such as Chardonnay Marks Bourbon, Jeff Crepuscule, Colby Slump, Yevgeny Espadrille Rand, and Ulla von Trapp from Cologne, who was terminally bored, too cool for school, and always banging on about how she was friends with Martin Kippenberger. One of my favourites to write was Keith Gorgon, an ageing and humourless British Marxist critic who'd never quite gotten over the 60s, an amalgam of people I'd actually met. And then there was the kind and thoughtful January Cocteau Lund, whose job as the Rocky and Ludmilla Stallion Tamer, curator of contemporary solace, was to look after the residents at the St. Lucy Hospital for dematerialised artists. Here's a letter from January. As the Rocky and Ludmilla Stallion Tamer, curator for contemporary solace at the St. Lucy Hospice for dematerialised artists in Guernsey, I must thank you for your survey, How Has Art Changed?, which has caused much debate amongst the patients here, many of whom will soon, it must be said, be post-human. Muffled arguments rage from beneath the rugs on the deck chairs, one of the most contentious being the role of the metaphor in a time of paradigm shifts. Curiously, no other issue of Frieze has quite resuscitated the spirit of Ruskin as this one has. As one artist, his sight failing fast, murmured to me through his monochrome lips, "Since the first dominion of men was asserted over the ocean, three thrones of mark beyond all others have been set upon its sands. The thrones of Tyre, Venice, and England." Sorry, my eyesight's fading as well. There were regular venues that cropped up. There was the Poisoned Barrel, a pub in Hackney that was an amalgam of every grotty East End pub we'd been to following a gallery opening. There were the preposterous art museums and galleries, Three Strikes Gallery in LA, Jeroboam Splendide in Paris, the John O'Groats Contemporary Art Lab, Scotland, the Contemporary Institute Centre Foundation in Aspen, and the locker near the new sushi bar at Schiphol Airport where Ubu Stevenson kept his art collection. Eventually, at some point around 2008, we ended the letters page for reasons which maybe we can come to in the discussion. Occasionally, Ubu Stevenson would return for a guest spot, usually in the guise of extracts from a book or for an issue we did themed around art and activism, an extract from one of his many memoirs, this one called Spam the Barricades. And so, here we go. As many of those involved in the events of May 68, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Occupy movement, the release of Aung San Suu Kyi, and the Arab Spring will tell you, my work as a curator has played a defining role in setting a radical agenda for millions of political activists, peace campaigners, defenders of liberty, power-crazed ideologues, and bloodthirsty warlords across the world. It's been a testament to the indefatigable sovereignty and merciless might of curating as a profession, not to mention exhibition making as a terrifyingly powerful assault weapon, that exhibitions of mine such as Molotov Cocktails Are On Me, Swindon Community Centre, 1969, War, Is It Really That Bad?, Defence and Security Events International Arms Fair, London 2009, expensive pictures of riot police beating a litter of defenceless kittens and puppies in front of the Bank of England, John O'Groats Contemporary Arts Lab, 2011, and my unrealised project for Documenta 9, Eat Lead, Goddamn Commie Nazis, have had such a profound impact on global geopolitics. The mark they've made is one so incalculably huge in scope that as yet nobody has commented upon it. But after a run of 5 or 6 years, we realised the joke had worn flat, and it was time to put Obi Stephen out of his misery, send him to the great big curating conference in the sky, from where he's never made a second coming. But I'll leave you, if I've got time, with an extract from another of his memoirs. Livid at not being included in Sarah Thornton's book, 7 Days in the Art World, Obi Stevenson paid Frieze an undisclosed sum to publish the following exclusive extract from the preface to his sociological bodice ripper, Don't You Know Who I Am, Actualizing Myself in the Art World. Fr- fresh from delivering a stunning comparative analysis of my career with that of other major international curators as my contribution to the 2008 Gordon Rhizome Pomplemousse Memorial Lecture Series at the Contemporary Center Institution Foundation, Aspen, I decided one evening to enjoy a cup of sake at the Shirasagi Sushi Bar in Lounge 2 of Schiphol Airport after my regular jog between gates 1 and 18. As the warm ginger shoe gradually laid me flat underneath the bar stools, it struck me that as one of the world's most important cultural practitioners, many people had embraced the opportunity to learn more about my work. As my friend Willem, head of airport security, slung me over his shoulder to carry me back to my Herzog and de Meuron design department near runway 18L36R, I resolved to humbly reveal the everyday workings of my geopolitical cultural praxis to you in book form. The publication you're now reading is a groundbreaking travelogue recorded on my iPhone as I jetted between international curating seminars, multi-international biennials, transcontinental book launches, and exclusive dinners with Russian oligarchs. It probes every corner of the art world and leaves no private view unattended, no major retrospective of a white male artist unremarked upon, and no collector's private jet untraveled in. The opening chapter, Making an Exhibition of Myself, describes my curatorial practice, which I've practiced very hard at, from the early days of boundary trespassing shows such as my 1968 exhibitions The Gallery Must Be Destroyed and The Gallery Really Must Be Rebuilt Again, through to Trapped Inside the Dematerialized Gallery, 1975, Locked Out Trying to Enter the Rematerialized Gallery, 1977, and recent projects such as Expand the Gallery, 2001, Build Another Gallery, 2002, and Why Have One Space When You Can Have Five, 2007. It finishes with my forthcoming show, Repossession, Selling the Contemporary Project Space, 2009. The chapter also explores at length the major biennials I have contributed to, including the 78th Swansea Septennial, Interrogating Extinction, the 4th Galapagos Quadrennial, and Never Say Die, the minus 8th Equatorial Guinea Annuale, now very much a fixture in the international art calendar. Chapter 2, Was It Me or Jacques Rancière Who Said?, explores the world of art criticism, examining my work in the mid-1970s as editor of the conceptual magazine Turn Left, which I decided to fold before its first issue in order to maintain its critical integrity. It continues with a look at my recent editorship of the Austerity Review, renowned for paying galleries not to advertise lest they compromise the writing, and only covering artists who can pass a written examination on the early work of Giorgio Agamben. It also looks at Great Show, a London-based monthly comprising photographs from openings. Finally, it glances at my work as contributing editor in the 1980s to New York magazines Oh Andy and Guest List, and also includes many reviews I've written of my own books and exhibitions, and a coruscating attack on corruption in the art world. The third chapter, If You Want a Job Done Right, Do It Yourself, examines my influential role as an educator. As adjunct professor of multidisciplinary Wikipedia studies at the Jack Vetriano Academy of Arts in Laos, I have been instrumental in teaching generations of students that they must reach beyond the sphere of their capabilities in order to connect art with the broader worlds of science, politics, economics, philosophy, music, architecture, dance, event catering, international diplomacy, and Premier League football. It also looks at shows I've curated in support of emerging students at such emerged spaces as Asbo Projects and West End Boys in London and Three Strikes Gallery, Los Angeles. The section ends with a spirited repudiation of Keith Gorgon's recent attacks on my methods in the pamphlet Teacher, Leave Those Kids Alone. Chapter 4, I'm almost done, titled I Spoke to the Intern Earlier Who Said My Name Should Be on the List, takes a hard-hitting look at the art world's networks of power, privilege, and money. The high regard with which I'm held has enabled me to access many of the most powerful figures in today's art world, and invitations to lavish dinners and luxury holidays on expensive Greek islands. Here I bravely publish exposés of figures such as Rocky and Ludmilla Stallion Tamer, and describe just what wonderful people they are, how much work they do for charity, and their tireless support of my career. Also revealed is the blameless career of Rasputin Jones, who has nothing whatsoever to do with arms dealing and lives all year round in international waters on his yacht L'Evasion Fiscale purely for his love of the high seas. The final chapter in the book concerns a project very close to my heart, but one I've not yet been able to realise due to my busy timetable. Sensation, the musical. This is the story of young British artists told through the medium of song and dance, and features such numbers as Let's Just Do the Show Right Here, My Heart Skipped a Beat When I Met the Drummer from Blur, and Next Stop, Venice. The chapter features the full score and libretto to the musical. And that was the story of Jean-Philippe Auguste.
Hi, I'm Ruth Graham. And I'm here basically as, as just a fan of Letters to the Editor, and I have a particular interest in the letter sections of mainstream middlebrow publications, so Vanity Fair and Entertainment Weekly and these. So I'm glad Carrie and Dan have sort of covered like highbrow hijinks and like big intellectual debates, and I'm about to read to you from People magazine, so I'm interested in sort of that human spectacle aspect of letters. So the first letters to the editor I really paid attention to were the letters in the Chicago Tribune in the 80s and the 90s, which was the first section of the paper I started reading when I branched out from the comics page as a kid. I never read the articles that the letters were referring to, but I had this sense by reading these letters that I was tapping into this like grown-up conversation that I otherwise just had no access to as a suburban kid. And I think that is part of the appeal of letter sections, is feeling, even when you do have that kind of access, that you're tapping into these like debates in your community, whether that means, you know, literally your local community or your intellectual community, or whatever the case may be. So today, obviously, I do have access to adult conversations because I'm an adult. And there's also just the fact that since that period, the internet, you know, we now have this like fire hose of conversation of all kind, grown up, not so grown up. But I still love letters to the editor as this artifact. And if anything, I think I love them more now because they do seem so quaint compared to the kind of conversations that we have access to online. Comment sections are, you know, they try hard to be clever, or they're cruel, they're just garbage. And so, I mean, when it comes to my own work, when that's published, I never read the comments, but I always want to read the letters to the editor. I think, obviously, you know, letters are gentler, and that is because, in large part, they're curated, so you're just kept, you know, the garbage is filtered out. But I also think it's not just about being gentler, but that letters sections, especially in the kind of mainstream publications that I write for, so newspapers, and I write for Slate, places like that, although they don't do letters, but they do a comment section that I don't read. But letters are often these just perfect, or letter sections, these like repositories of just absolute conventional wisdom. So they're not hot takes, they're like room temperature takes. And so in letter sections, like, animal abuse is bad, ISIS is bad, cancer is the ultimate evil, the letter I just saw, which I don't actually know if you can call a biological, I'm not sure if cancer is evil, but so and so on and so forth. It's just like the absolute most obvious possible opinions. My favorite letter, I was reading them in my local paper this week. It started with this sentence, which I just love. Without knowing 100% of the details as it pertains to Principal John Forrest of Beaver Meadow, I'm truly disappointed at the way our society is going. And I just love that turn from like an obscure local like school controversy to this like grand statement about the way society is going. I don't like the way society is going either, so, you know, good job, letter writer, I guess. So in magazines, here's another example of kind of what I'm talking about. But after the German Wings plane crash this spring, there was a letter in People that started this way. To end your own life is one thing, but to murder 149 souls is beyond comprehension, exclamation point. So that is true. It's indisputably true, but it's so indisputable that it makes me curious about the kind of person who would, like, first of all, think that. We all thought that, but then, like, write it down and send it into a national magazine and be like, I must be heard. This is a horrible event, and it's incomprehensible. It's just this perfectly banal conventional wisdom. So I think in some ways the kind of the online tone, like the smartass internet people that I consider myself one of, but we sort of need that conventional wisdom that you find in letter sections to be more interesting than, or define yourself against, or like have a like a twist on the kind of logic and thought that's found in letter sections. All this is kind of similar to what I love about a different genre of letter to the editor, and Carrie mentioned this briefly, but the really, really positive, gushing letters that appear in magazines like Vogue, People, Entertainment Weekly. They're just letters from enthusiasts about either the publication itself or one of its subjects, in celebrity magazines especially. So I'll just read a few of my favorites of this genre from the last few years. I just sort of tend to collect these. So this one's from Entertainment Weekly. Not since your 2001 Friends Ultimate Viewers Guide, which I saved in my bottom desk drawer, have I been this excited about an in-depth TV story. With its strong cast, long-running jokes, and quirky storytelling style, How I Met Your Mother has proved that sitcoms can be hilarious while tugging at your heartstrings. It's from Trisha Young in Philadelphia. Here's one from, this is just an excerpt from one from the Southwest Airlines In-Flight magazine. I love LUV, so they're using Southwest's own like internal branding language. I don't think they lose the heart. I love the little fun facts you always include in the numbers. Who knew a raindrop can weigh 50 times as much as a mosquito? But what I love most are your stories about people. Surely I cannot be the only Southwest passenger that tears up while I read your magazine. this is one from Vanity Fair. I can personally vouch for Sam Kashner's praise of Mike Nichols' quick wit. One afternoon in the 1980s, okay, so this is like 30 years ago. This person has been like working, you know, thinking about this story. Just prepare yourself. While trying on a jacket in a men's shop on Madison Avenue, I turned away from the three-way mirror at the same time another man, whom I instantly recognized as Mike Nichols, turned away from his mirror. Both of us were wearing the same jacket in like a clothing store. It's not that weird. We stared at each other. He nodded at me in a complimentary way and said, "Nice jacket." I don't think that's that witty. I don't know. But this guy has been turning it over as this kernel of like Mike Nichols' perfect wit for 30 years. Finally, here's this one's from People magazine. Desperate Housewives star Eva Longoria is one of the most beautiful women in the world. I always wondered what makeup products she applied to make her skin always look so breathtaking. Thanks to your Look of the Week feature, I now know what cosmetics she uses. Best of all, her choices are affordable. So some of these sound fake, right? And I, you know, if you sort of Google around, you will find stories of editors, you know, you don't even have to Google. Here's Dan. But of former magazine employees and editors saying that they have spent time making letters like this up for publication. And these names, like Erin Sanchez and Austin, like, how could you possibly find that person? You know, there's, like, no way to prove if she's a real person or not, or just Eva Longoria, super fan. I've been curious about this over the years, and I do know now, Carrie also mentioned this story that I did, I guess, a year and a half or so ago now, but I did track down a bunch of letter writers of this style of letter for The All, and I just interviewed them about why they write letters. So I had this kind of superior attitude to this story going into it, and I just thought it would be like kind of hilarious because what kind of person writes this? It's absurd. And I just thought it would sort of end up being like a funny story, but it ended up actually being really poignant. It turned out very differently than I thought. So I'll just tell you, I won't read like my whole story, but I'll just tell you a little bit about the people I talked to. One woman had a letter published in Vanity Fair that read in part, "Kerry Washington's presentation both on and off screen mesmerizes and frankly flatters all women." Kerry Washington's beautiful, I mean. So she turned out to be, she was a 63-year-old retired postal worker in Houston. She had worked toward a college degree in writing, but had never finished it. She knew the exact number of credits she had, and it was like this ongoing you know, it was like, it was clearly looming large in her mind. And she had had, she was a frequent letter writer. I think she'd had 7 published in Architectural Digest alone, and was constantly sending them out to other similar publications. So she told me when I, you know, sort of just asked her what she got out of this, she said, first of all, that her kids kind of razzed her about, like, never getting paid for letters to the editor, which was an interesting, like, I never even thought about that entering a person's mind. But that was, like, part of it for her, was that she, like, knew she was doing it for free. But she said, I hope that maybe it means something that I'm a literate person, literate enough to write a book. It's something I get a lot of pride from. And you could hear it. I mean, she was really, really proud to sort of, like, see her name in print in this way. So I also spoke to an 84-year-old man in Washington State who had a letter published in People just praising their coverage of the birth of Prince George. And actually, this was not as touching. It was just kind of weird. But he seemed primarily to be trying to get the attention of Piers Morgan, who he was like a longtime fan of. And he had like, he recounted to me like how he had a line about Piers Morgan in the letter, but people took it out, but that's okay. Like, he'll get through to Piers, you know, some other way. And there was, let's see, where did this guy have a letter? There was a former middle school and high school journalism teacher in Florida who used to have his students write letters to the editor, similar to the Times Project that Lori was mentioning, but just as a writing exercise, crafting argument, and you know, which makes a lot of sense to me. So, and he had been a lifelong fan, super fan, of the actress Julie Harris, a stage actress mostly, and he had a letter published about her in People, I think soon after she died. He like keeps this big file on her, and he believes that there's significance in the fact that their birthdays were a few days apart. And so he basically like spent an hour talking with me about Julie Harris. But he said his only other letter had been published about an issue with some kind of homophobic incident in his small town in Florida. And so he said, the times I've written letters, it's been something like Julie Harris or bigotry, something I've tried to express an opinion about, but hope that people might read it and be affected. I just love that, like, Julie Harris and bigotry. And then the last one was, and probably the most moving to me, it was a 30-something woman in New York, a black woman working at a pretty high level on Wall Street. And she also had written about this Kerry Washington issue of Vanity Fair. And I should say I was kind of limited by the fact that I sort of had to see who I could Google. So I, you know, was reading like tons of these letters, and some of them are like Erin Sanchez in Austin, and I'll just never find her. I have no idea. Like, so anyway, it was people with like somewhat unique names. She told me, this Kerry Washington letter writer, that she had read the magazine for many years, and just seeing Kerry Washington there sort of felt, made her feel like she belonged as a reader. So here's what she told me in part. No one really looks like me in the field of work that I do on Wall Street. I saw the cover and it hit me. Hey, in my free time, most of the time I'm paying to feel this kind of outsider feeling that I feel every day. It's not just a matter of subscribing to a magazine with women in it or black people in it. There are a lot of magazines out there that I don't relate to, but I love the content in Vanity Fair, and I just wanted to feel like I could set down my suitcase while reading Vanity Fair. This was one of the very few issues where I felt like that. So I find that touching. And it seemed like by the end of the time that I was working on this and doing this reporting that even when people are writing letters that seem really frivolous or really obvious or even just dumb, my sense afterwards is that people do get a lot of validation from seeing their names in print, and that a lot of times, especially in these big mainstream middle-brow publications, it's people that don't have access to that in a lot of other ways. And, you know, I'm a journalist, and I've, you know, upon reflection, have spent my life trying to get my name in print, so, like, how superior can I be about people's instinct to see their name? I've, like, spent years reaching for that exact same kind of validation, so even though I do, there's some, like, silly pleasure for me still in reading letters to the editor, and I still get that same kind of silly pleasure. But I think it's ultimately something very normal and human about wanting to be heard and wanting to be respected. So that's that.
Thank you. So that's really interesting, the contrast here. And in terms of, you talked about, Ruth, that your project was more about the middle brow, but I was interested in the, it seems to me Vanity Fair is a very different publication than Entertainment Weekly, and I was wondering if you noticed, distinctions, and also that was the letter where you said this felt like a very poignant and kind of statement that she was really making, the idea of putting down her suitcase and being validated, you know. So I wondered if you felt like it was the... That are there distinctions that could be made among them? And
I honestly think it's not a huge distinction. I mean, obviously Vanity Fair is like dressed up in kind of a, it like fancies itself different from Entertainment Weekly, but I'm not that convinced that it is that different at its core. Like, it still is a celebrity magazine that you're sort of reading to escape and like ooh and ah at the lives of, and I mean Entertainment Weekly is a little bit different because it's, but in some way, I mean, it's like criticism, and so I can see how one is meant to be sort of smarter than the other, but when I read the letters, there's a tone and there's like a self-seriousness about Vanity Fair, but I honestly don't see them as differently as probably those magazines see each other.
And then just another follow-up comment, and then I'll have a general question. But it seems that they're serving a very different purpose than the goal of controversy that I was kind of highlighting, and that Dan was talking about being so frustrated with the banality of the letters that you were actually receiving, the lack of the total dearth of letters, right? Yeah. But the letters that you were receiving seems like that it seemed like an eruption. Those pseudonyms seemed like an eruption in response to too much banality, and yet seeking banality. So thinking about what the letters do for the magazines is a question that maybe we could discuss. And I mean, is it just endorsing the magazines? I mean, is it that simple that it's just a form of?
Although in most of, sure, I mean, I think that's a huge, percentage of them. But they will, I mean, there are controversies when people get mad about, like, who's left off a list of, like, the greatest sitcoms of the 2000s so far or something. I mean, so you still do kind of get, at whatever level the magazine is operating at, you do still get controversies, and they, you know, they don't go on for 10 months or in such... in such depth, but you do, when you were reading that list of like the different functions or like the three different, the functions of letters to the editor, I mean, I think you see all those in every magazine at every level.
Okay.
I'm particularly interested in the ones that are just purely positive because they just seem to evaporate. Like, what are those for? Those are the most mysterious to me, especially in terms of, from the perspective of the writer.
Right.
Well, that's it. So yeah, just something on that topic of positivity. I think that's very interesting because, like, within the culture of art magazines, this idea that you might actually be enthusiastic about something is just sort of like, there's something about the culture of like the art magazine, you know, where you've got to be critical and you have a serious sort of opinion. And the idea that you might have just seen something and really liked it, there's a kind of embarrassment about that. You know, so letters pages in art magazines, you know, never have anyone going, that was a great show, wasn't it?
Right,
And it may be a brow distinction, too.
Yeah, it's a brow distinction.
Of the New Yorker and Atlantic Monthly letters, which are really like a form of journalism. I mean, people write in and their credentials are impressive, and often they're more credentialed in the area that they're in a way.
Right.
You know, they'll write in as I'm, a professional ecologist and I have an opinion and I want to add something to the art. It's not always critical necessarily, but that might be I don't know.
Credentialed people have enthusiasms too.
Yeah.
Credentialed people are, you know, humans who have kind of feelings about things too.
Right, but the magazines seem to deselect the enthusiasm in these, I don't know, if we're comfortable with the brand. I wondered if you wanted to talk, Dan, a little bit about the From the Mailbox column that was
was producing real letters that I thought they were bogus letters, but and why you discontinued it and what the editing process was, and maybe you can address that idea of editorial intervention.
So we finished the letters page partly because, as I mentioned, like the joke had kind of run its course, and then I think if my memory serves me correctly, we had another redesign at that point. And so the position of, this is just a very sort of boring, it was a boring technical thing, like the position of the masthead shifted. And so we had a page where there was about a quarter of the page width was taken up with the masthead. And then we needed space filler. So we tried out various things, like we had the artist David Trigley just like do a drawing for us each issue for a while, which was great, you know, everyone likes David Trigley, but we thought, you know, well, let's try and sort of switch it up a bit more. And one idea we had was this from the mailbag column, because working on a magazine, you get a huge amount of correspondence sent to you on a daily basis, and a lot of it, you know, it's like stuff from PR companies or galleries sending out, you know, like press releases and those sorts of mail outs. But you get some really weird, like really, really batshit crazy stuff, like kind of being sent to you, totally unsolicited. And these weren't letters to us. They weren't like letters to the editor, really. They were like a lot of like oddly kind of self-promotional stuff, or just like press releases that we got, which were just so badly written that we just thought we must share these with the world. So we put together a selection of those and edit out. We'd edit them basically for concision, really. We never wanted to, and we often removed removed names if it was anyone. If it was like a letter that had been written to us that was just sort of so ridiculously pompous and arrogant or whatever, you know, that we had sort of felt it was funny to show. But we removed the names. You know, we never like said the name of what gallery had sent a press release or anything like that. You know, just sort of tried to have some sort of circumspection about it. And it was sort of, you know, some of them were funny. Other issues, it's sort of, you know, it'd been like a dull month and it wasn't really working out, so it was space filler that wasn't quite as entertaining as we'd hoped. And then eventually someone recognised something that they'd written appearing in the mail section, from the mailbag section. No, they weren't happy, they were quite upset. So, understandably perhaps, because it, you know, it was like we were kind of mocking them. And I think that was just the point where, you know, we sort of checked ourselves and decided not to run those anymore.
Okay. Just so the audience gets a taste of what this column was about, because I didn't find it entertaining. I don't have the column in front of me, but some quotes from it. A lot of the people, as Dan said, were marketing their art or the art of their loved ones and you know, the person they were representing. So things that were being called art include a product billed as pre-stained underwear, and then an installation piece consisting of a pair of penguins and a pair of polar bears suspended from London's Millennium Bridge as a protest against global warming, and two triptychs inspired by Francis Bacon, inspired by an artist by an artist in zero gravity conditions. So they were so outrageous, I was sure they were both.
I think some of them we weren't actually intending to mock anyone. I think some of them were just like, this is just bonkers, you know, and kind of delightfully so. You know, this is amazing, this person's done this thing, and nobody in the art world is going to take them seriously. You know, they're not going to get a show reviewed, they're not going to get picked up by Gagosian or anything like that. But, you know, this is a person out there in the world with an imagination and doing something, and, you know, maybe it's quite nice to sort of highlight that. So there was, there was from time to time a slightly more kind of like, you know, nice sort of positive, benevolent kind of reason for us doing it.
Can I ask Anna a question? I'm just curious, like, if you got any reaction to the letters, because you're creating this, like, narrative over the course of years and these characters, and, I mean, I'm curious not just if people sort of noticed that you were making them up, but just did you get feedback? Because it's just sort of delightful.
Thanks. to begin with, I mean, as I mentioned, like, there were some people... like when the first of those O.B. Stevenson letters was printed, there were some people who wondered if he was actually real, right. Which says really does say a lot about what was happening in the art world in 2004. You know, this is like pre 2008 crash. This is right. A moment when like lots and lots of power tectonics are shifting, and you've got conference after conference after article talking about how the critic is useless, you know, mm-hmm. now, and it's all about the curators, and mm-hmm. you know, this sort of like funny kind of political tectonics moving around. And so it just sort of seemed, you know, when you've got figures like real life figures like Hans-Ulrich Obrist, this, you know, this Swiss curator who travels around the world, you know, just goes to like Melbourne for 48 hours and then flies to Moscow for a conference. You know, we just thought it was interesting that people thought that was actually a possibility. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, some people really enjoyed them and really kind of found them funny. And then other people found them, they thought we were just mocking the profession mm-hmm. and that it was really, really not, it was really unseemly for an art mm-hmm. magazine to be doing that. But that question of satire, I think, was one that we were interested in. Mm-hmm. Because our art magazines don't have a voice for... They don't have a space for satire either, or like sort of self-reflexive mockery, or kind of or anything like that. You know, Frieze is like it's a glossy art magazine, which you know has its kind of aura is like that of like lots of art magazines, like Art Forum or After All or whatever. It's serious. You know, its tone is of seriousness and of taking itself seriously.
So that was the only place where this could
Yeah, and I think that, for one thing, like, we as editors laugh a lot in the office. You know, there's a lot of, like, laughter that goes on. We kind of, you know, there's a lot of joking, and it was quite nice to kind of, like, have a space to actually put that somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think, secondly, it was about trying to make the magazine appear slightly more friendly. Because I think there's a standoffishness that comes off like a certain type of very, you know, sort of highbrow cultural magazine, you know, where it's all about the pieties of seriousness that you have to kind of, you know, observe. And so we were quite interested in the idea of like, well, what happens if you sort of just kind of, you know, tease it a bit, you know, if you sort of poke fun in a quite a sort of gentle way. I mean, that was the other reason why we didn't really want to have real names in it too. You know, we sort of dallied with that, but it just felt wrong. It's just sort of nicer to sort of, you know, do something where no one was really actually going to get hurt, but you could still sort of vent. It was a bit of like a pressure valve, you know, all the stuff that, you know, anyone who maybe works in the art world probably feels from time to time, you know, about its absurdities or its, you know, its pomposities and certain kind of proclivities towards self-seriousness. You know, we thought that it might be quite nice to allow some sort of venting of that in public.
I mean, you talked about the initial impetus being a lack of reader response or banal reader response, and did it. So you asked the question, you know, how do people respond to these pseudonyms? But also, did it liven up? That it didn't. I mean, you didn't wind up. You still didn't get.
Still
didn't
get any readers.
Who were responding to the magazine.
No. Well, it ended up then becoming like quite sort of hermetic and sort of self. You know, it became its own world, so then nobody would write.
Right, mm-hmm. They're not invited in.
They're not invited in because then it becomes its own sort of like fictional space.
Right.
I think we'll take some questions from the audience. If anyone has them, I'll give you the mic.
I have just a really simple question that maybe can be unmiked.
Okay.
In researching the letters, exploring the letters, are there basically two types of letters? That is, someone who writes about an issue, mm-hmm. somebody that is. Or the publication, and those who care about the identity of a given periodical, so they only would ever write to the New York Review mm-hmm. of Books. But for them, that is an institution. It has raised the standard, and they would only write for where they're at home, which might not mm-hmm. just be the New York Review of Books, but might be a small group. Are there kind of two types of letter writers? Those you believe to be actually real?
I mean, I think everyone. Or every letter writer, I mean, no one's going to write to, like, Entertainment Weekly and the New York Review of Books, probably, you know, unless they, I guess, are, like, a miniature horse fan. But even, and actually, like, sort of form opinion letters are a big issue for newspaper editors, and I don't know, maybe magazines, too, although I think not as much so, but where around a certain issue, like, an activist group will... like hand out a template and people will send it out. And sometimes like journalism blogs will catch this and be like, here, this almost identical letter to the editor has run in like 25 local newspapers across the country. I don't know if that exactly answers your question or not, but I think everyone, like the woman who had written to Vanity Fair and Architectural Digest, I mean, she's writing to those sort of like upper middle brow, like Condé Nast style glossy magazines primarily. She'd also written to Essence and some like Black Interest magazines. So I don't know. I think everyone targets to what they read and the level they feel like they're at or where they feel like their people are. And other people, of course, do just like bang the same issue drum kind of endlessly. So.
And similarly, in historical examples, that one writer that they were making fun of, saying she's officer, she's in again, Alice Graf, who she wrote something like 20 letters in the space of 2 years to the Little Review, so she was a frequent correspondent. But she also wrote to Poetry Magazine, and she wrote to little magazines. That was sort of her her niche. And so you said they would cross over. And also, an interesting thing we didn't really talk about, kind of came up maybe a couple of times so far, is celebrities writing, and or you talked about soliciting letters from established people in the field. That's a, another phenomenon in letters columns. So in the new age, suddenly there's was a discussion about sort of race relations, and suddenly W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in, who you know had founded the Crisis and was a major figure in the NAACP. So it, and just interesting to me that it was, he was even reading the New Age and so on. So you get celebrities, you know, making, and that can function as a kind of endorsement, inviting the celebrities in and to you know, kind of raise the discourse level. But also I think he was just pissed off that, about the way they were covering this topic. And so he was functioning as a reader, not as a, you know, celebrity voice. Yeah. So.
This just reminds me, like, a few weeks ago in my, like, little local paper, the poet Donald Hall wrote in about, like, a local water development issue and sort of didn't, I mean, he signed it Donald Hall, but it was, like, not at all in his capacity as a literary figure, but, he, you know, he was, like, upset about this this water development, so, yeah.
And kind of Frank Lloyd Wright wrote in about the blank pages issue and kind of it was kind of mixed about how he felt about that. Doesn't dispel the end of the magazine, but, you know, bravo. So,
other questions?
This is a purely speculative question. There's no real right or wrong answer to this, but I was hoping that maybe you guys could just put out your opinions about, you know, talking about people writing in with pseudonyms and also this sort of completely self-referential fake letters, you know, why the format of the letters to the editor sort of permits the sort of suspension of disbelief, or, you know, what contract is being performed or created between the reader and the editor in this space? You know, why do people assume that it's real all the time, and where, you know, where does that assumption come from? I mean, this is clearly different for any given magazine, but just maybe your thoughts on that.
That's a good question. I mean, I think there is something about the form of letters to the editor that's inherently like read as sincere. And so that maybe that makes that space fun to sort of play with and tweak and satirize with, you know, within itself. Anonymous, you know, or you know, fake names, or I don't know that there's like one ethical answer to that. I think it just depends on magazine and what's expected, and I guess if it's an outright fraud that no one is in on, I guess that is problematic. But I don't have like a strong across the board stance on that, I guess.
I think it is a good question. I think. You know, when you do get like a real letter that comes in, that's sort of that's what, and you publish a real letter, that's what kind of just keeps it lively and interesting, doesn't it? You know, it's like that's what keeps readers guessing. Well, are these other ones real or are they fake? Mm-hmm. You know, if there's an absolutely genuine real one from a real established known person out in the world that appears in your letters page, then that sort of that like verifies the veracity of the other ones. You know, that kind of ratifies the veracity of the other ones. That is, yeah, it's a fun and interesting thing to play with. I mean, you know, magazines and newspapers don't have to have letter sections, mm-hmm. but it's a convention that's just sort of, you know, that's stuck, and they've got to fill those spaces mm-hmm. somehow. You know, a newspaper on deadline, if it's not got enough letters, they still need to fill that kind of that space. So there's sometimes just like a really, really pragmatic reason for doing it, rather than it having anything to do with, you know, sort of like a higher sort of conceptual level of motivation.
I was going to add, I think that there is an assumption of veracity mm-hmm. unless there are the signals, mm-hmm. right, that this is a bogus, you know, it's a pseudonym, and that readers can certainly feel. Other readers can certainly feel betrayed or like that. I think there is a contract, you know, that mm-hmm. if it's not signaled that this is a concocted letter, I think readers can feel betrayed. And I'm thinking about, well, a lot of the pseudonyms that Beatrice Hastings used, other readers, presumably real readers, would then write in and engage with those pseudonyms. And they were assuming that these were all distinct and real people. And so there's a kind of manipulation there. And I'm also thinking about a recent, more in the last few years, but the Times issuing an apology for having published a letter that they thought was real, but they should have done the identity check on the person that they, you know, somebody dropped the ball and they published something that was objectionable about, I don't know, the French president or something, and that they didn't check their facts and verify who this letter writer was. So that was another instance of a kind of broken contract, or mm-hmm. at least the Times felt they had to apologize for it.
One thing we get occasionally at Freeze is people writing letters to the editor that they don't want published. Which is a really odd thing. Like they'll write
just to the editor.
Yeah, yeah. This is just to you. Yeah. Pretty nice. private little moment. Private little chat. You quite often it's to do with something that they feel angry about. So I mean, we had an instance recently in the magazine where a very negative review had been run, and we got a. Two, I think three incredibly angry letters about it. And we offered to publish them. It's like, well, you know, you're making if you really disagree and think that, you know, we've overstepped the mark in publishing this particular review, then you're very, very welcome to use, you know, the forum of the magazine, and we'll publish your letter. And none of them wanted it published. They didn't want to actually make that public within the space of Freeze.
I wonder if it's because there wasn't a pre-existing space, so they weren't joining a kind of conventional. Do you know what I mean? If they felt like they would be too much in the spotlight and
it's possible.
Set something like that, but that's interesting.
But it sounds like you think that they, when they really thought, okay, this will be exposed to public judgment of reason, mm-hmm. that they will not thrive in that forum. The personal, private might allow them, but then they reread it and say, well, no, actually.
Well,
it sounds like that, or I thought I was hearing that in your voice. Okay.
That's what that person thinks.
Yeah, were you surprised that they didn't want to have their letters published?
No, not really. I mean, sometimes, you know, someone just does want to have just a personal word with rant at you, you know, and that's fine. And, you know, when we wrote back, we said that, you know, it was a very sort of, you know, straightforward and polite reply we wrote, saying, you know, thank you for your letter. You know, we'd be very happy to publish this. And you know, just please let us know if you'd like that. And they did, and they replied saying, "No, I'd just rather you didn't publish it." Mm-hmm. There was no sort of like reason given, so I don't really know. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why one could, you know, speculate on why they didn't want it published. I think one there's another sort of tradition in letters, which is the reply. So, you know, the rebuttal. So someone writes a letter in saying, you know, I thought your article on miniature horses was outrageous. And then the author of the article on miniature horses gets to say, well, hang on, you know, I think I researched this and I, you know, I wrote this for X, Y, and Z reasons. So I don't know, maybe they didn't want to have that fight in public with the author or something. I'm not sure.
I have a question for you, and then I'll let you speak. So, Ruth, the letters you described sound like ideal readers in a way, mm-hmm. like the most genuine, mm-hmm. heartfelt readers modeled in the letter section. And so I'm wondering, actually, Dan, if you have any letters that you don't publish. It sounds like that might not be the case, but it seems mm-hmm. like a lot of magazines cultivate this kind of idealized reader through that section, whether they be real or not. So does that ever happen?
I think the only times we would not publish something is if it's, or not at least offer to publish something, would be if it's highly abusive or if it's just obviously the work of someone that had some problems. We had one a couple of weeks ago from someone, and it started out fine, started out saying, dear editors, I read such and such an article, was very interested, and then it went on for about 500, 600 words, and it started to get very, very free association and kind of quite sort of jazz-like, and it just didn't really seem appropriate to publish that, because I don't think that person was necessarily in control of their mind.
I have a more cynical suspicion. I wonder what you think about. I was thinking in terms of the more kind of more mainstream commercial magazines, where we're in an age with native ads that are getting so sophisticated, mm-hmm. you really have a hard time telling the difference between them and real articles. That in these types of magazines, that the letters to the editor section is completely fabricated and completely done in-house.
Like I was saying, you can find accounts of editors and former editors saying that they made up letters. From what I can tell, when I was on staff at a magazine, we didn't run letters, so I don't have inside information on this. But I think it more is just we have this space to fill, rather than coordinating with the ad side to produce editorial content to match, to match ads. I think. First of all, I think that would be a fairly big scandal if it got out, of a different order than it is just to be making up letters to fill space. And it is a mini, you can read these stories on Gawker, so it's considered newsy, which does mean, it suggests that it's considered a little bit surprising that magazine staffers make up some of these letters. But I don't know. I've never seen, I think that would be a conspiracy that would be too hard to hold together and too hard to pull off. So my best guess is that it's just done out of desperation to fill space. I was actually talking with a friend about this last night, who works for a magazine that I will not name, but was saying that a lot of their letters, and actually they've stopped running a letter to the editor section now. I kind of wonder if letter sections are a little bit in decline, but that a lot of those letters were generated by the editors sending out emails to their real friends and professional acquaintances saying please write letters. So then are those real letters? It's not something that's happening organically with people, spontaneously wanting to engage with content. But they're real names, and they're written technically by the people whose names they're under. So I don't know how often that kind of middle space happens, but yeah.
I wanted to, in response to that, mm-hmm. just share an example of an article I read about a magazine called Women's Hearth from the 1870s or so, which had an advice column, and all the products that were recommended were right in the ads pages. So certainly, I'm sure there are more contemporary examples, but certainly that's. But I think that the readers may have genuinely be asking, but the answer was tied into the ad. So.
Last question.
So Ruth, you touched on just sort of how comment sections are different from mm-hmm. letters to the editor, and you also mentioned that maybe letters to the editor declined maybe because of comment section. And I always wonder, reading, because I do read the comment sections because it's a fascinating portrait of humanity, but has there always been that much garbage and it's just been filtered out? Or is it just that much easier to write in a little box and hit a button than put a postage stamp, that is enough of a barrier to stop it?
I think, a historian might be a better person to answer this in terms of the garbage that flows into letters, into physical mailboxes. But that's a much higher barrier. It's a much harder hurdle. You have to write it down, either mail it in or even email it. It's harder to do. So I guess I would think that there would be less than there is on the internet. And it's such a tedious thing to observe, but obviously also people feel this sense of total freedom and anonymity online that they might not feel even with anonymous letters. And also just the volume, the amount of garbage in the comments just has to be higher than it ever was with.
Well, and the anonymity is key because I think even anonymous letters, typically the identity of the writer is verified off, you know, out of the publication. So they're not really anonymous. So the idea that, anybody can write into the comments.
Well, and you don't get to see, I mean, if you're an anonymous commenter, you sort of get to see the trouble that you stir up. And what's the payoff of just writing a mean letter that you know is never going to get published and mailing it? So that would be my guess, just based on human psychology, but not really. I'm not sure.
Well, thank you so much. And thank everyone. Thank you all for coming.